TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Kathy Kelly, Stop the War on Iraq. In 1996, Kathy Kelly co-founded Voices in the Wilderness, a Chicago-based campaign to end the U.S.-UN sanctions against Iraq. During the first 2 weeks of the Gulf War, she was part of a peace encampment on the Iraq-Saudi border. Very courageously, she and people from 18 different countries planned to be in the way of the invading forces. Later, Kathy Kelly and members of Voices traveled the road from Baghdad to Amman, while refugees were killed there by U.S. and U.K. bombs. Since then, a whole movement of nonviolent, compassionate action has sprung up. People from the U.S., including Kathy Kelly, have recently gone to occupied Palestine to ride with ambulances, stay in homes of Palestinians, or act as observers at army roadblocks. The presence of these so-called internationals has saved lives and given us a rare insight into the reality of that war. Voices in the Wilderness is now looking for individuals who are interested in going to Iraq in the event of a major U.S. assault. And you are about to hear from Kathy Kelly what these peace teams would actually do and how to become part of them. Kathy Kelly spoke at a conference of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. She put the current threat of war against Iraq in the context of the Gulf War and of the sanctions, which really are a war that never ended, more deadly in its impact on children and the elders than even the worst bombardments. The war now looming, she says, is foremost a war over oil. Kathy Kelly.
The United States is gearing up, I think in part because of George Bush's electoral campaign needs, in part because of the United States' desire to assure that any country in the world, right now particularly focused on the Middle East, that stands up to United States dominance, that says that it won't agree that its precious and irreplaceable resources should be sold to the United States at cut-rate prices, if it doesn't agree to the United States controlling the flow of petrodollars to assure that dollars that go into the Middle East from any country, Japan or Germany, who mainly derive their oil from the Middle East, and of course a great deal of Iraq's oil ends up coming back into the gas tanks in this country, but if countries don't agree that the recycling of those petrodollars should go back into U.S. banks, U.S. corporations, U.S. weapon-making companies, then the United States will punish them because that's a crime. To stand up to the United States on that level is a crime. And so I come from Chicago. St. Charles is in Missouri, and that's where one Boeing company is now working on 12-hour shifts, open 24 hours a day, manufacturing the equipment, the materials, so there will be enough of what they call the joint destruction action munition kits that can allow for surveillance. The cruise missiles that are also produced by Boeing are being refigured and rewired so that they won't have nuclear tips on them. They want those ones now to have conventional tips to be used, presumably, in an attack that seems almost imminent against Iraq. And, of course, when the haves and the have-nots become so disparate, then I suppose we could expect that people in great desperation will do what we've seen Palestinian suicide bombers do. Please don't hear me in the slightest try to justify random acts of violence that are targeted to take out people standing in bus centers, in cafes, in grocery stores. But I do feel that we need to understand here that even as though we might recoil and feel that it's repugnant for teenagers to go out and strap themselves up with explosives and be ready to take their own lives and those of others, we need to recognize that here we recruit teenagers at age 16 through ROTC, through high school programs, to be part of systematic violence that will take out whole cities full of grocery stores and cafes and bus stops. What is to be done? By way of invitation, I want to tell you of our plan to reenact the Gulf Peace Team, which was a very brave and plucky experiment in the further invention of nonviolence in 1991. We were 72 people from 18 different countries camped on the Iraq side of the Iraq-Saudi border, wanting to say basically don't shoot and intervene in between the warring parties, not aware, I'm not sure anyone could be at that time, that the war that would break out would be an air war, so that we couldn't have been more irrelevant. And as the planes flew over, we were filled with dismay, but we certainly weren't much of a deterrent. However, then eventually we were evacuated to Baghdad. We were there for 4 days and then evacuated clear out of Iraq to Jordan. And then we undertook what I thought was perhaps a slight deterrent to the continual attack on the roads between Amman and Baghdad. Attacking those roads totally violated Geneva Conventions, which say you always have to leave a way out for civilians and a way in for humanitarian relief. And the United States was mercilessly attacking those roads. As we left Baghdad while the war was still going on, our drivers had to swerve to miss huge craters that had been created by bombardments. And even the station chief from CBS was almost struck in his little Toyota when he was driving back and forth. So we determined to always be on those roads as much as we possibly could, bringing humanitarian relief in or driving out, accompanying drivers, taking refugees out. That was a clue to us of how in the future we might possibly be able to be in the way in the event of a major U.S. assault. So what we're planning now is the Iraq Peace Team. What we'd like to develop are affinity groups across the United States comprised of people who would be ready to go to Iraq if this assault occurs, who would be even starting now to try to get the funding by appealing to friends and relatives and community members, because it would be an expensive endeavor that would cost both the airfare and an extended stay, and also, you know, finding those people in your community who could clear a calendar for a significant stretch of time, because we don't know when it would be possible to come back. We also don't know when it would be likely to leave. So it would mean having the time free, the commitment to nonviolence, ideally some experience being in a war zone or in a situation of very heightened conflict and tension. Maybe it was be in a prison in your past experience, or maybe Catholic worker houses are always good for that. Or teaching high school, but some kind of, you know, experience of oneself under considerable stress. Those are the people that we'd be looking to participate in this. Some of us saw this work in Sarajevo in 1991 and in 1992. Particularly in 1991, Italians had worked out a very, very democratic representation of affinity groups for a 500-person strong team that went into Sarajevo. We were there for maybe 5 days during very, very intense bombing, and I never saw such discipline or such careful representation. I really believe that this can work, so you would be very, very invited to be in touch with us to help form this Iraq Peace Team. We have a delegation in Iraq right now, and two will follow, so there's plenty to do. If you know any people who are free and looking for a place to kind of fit in and are committed to nonviolence, and we'd certainly welcome them. We find that now that we've sent 42 delegations, that it is possible to go over to Iraq and come back, much as the Witness for Peace groups did in going to Central America, and just say, look, this is what we've seen and heard. Here are what ordinary people in Iraq have told us about their situation, although we don't ask people questions about their political situation there. It would be too dangerous to answer them. For the peace team, it's a different brief, if you will. We want to go over there and dwell with, take up residence in, not only Baghdad, but ideally Mosul in the north, Basra in the south, Fallujah and other smaller cities, and then have a third one team in Baghdad, one team in spread out between smaller cities, and then a third team that we call the road crew that would go between these various cities, so that if the United States decides to hit the northern trade routes or the lucrative oil fields in the south, We would not only be in Baghdad, we wouldn't want to be seen as trying to protect the regime necessarily. We'd also be in those places, and the U.S. would take the risk of bombing internationals and citizens from their own country who would already be there in advance. So this is a deterrent, and it's also to give witness to what would be happening to Iraqi people, ordinary Iraqi people, during a massive assault. And ideally to also fan out to some of the electrical facilities, the sewage and sanitation facilities, the schools, the bridges, and say, look, this is an infrastructure that people need if they're going to survive. The way to engage in training for these peace team efforts is to do it. You know, you get trained real fast in the immediate situation. I think a deep-seated commitment to nonviolence, a belief in the possibility of pacifism, is crucial. But people will always feel fears. There's nobody that goes forth into war zones, I don't think, that doesn't feel fear. But courage is the ability to control our fears, and the best way to get that courage, I think, is to catch it. We catch courage from one another, and then to be in the actual situation and learn how one governs one's fears so that you're not steered by fear. And that can happen here in this country as well. I think the people that go to prisons as part of the SOA, you know, learn how to marshal their fears in order to go through six or more months in U.S. prisons without being controlled by fear, much less be controlled by the fears of others, by the fears of loved ones. But it's very, very important, I think, that the groups that have the wider networks, groups like the Christian Peacemaker Team, American Friends Service Committee, that we rely on their voices to interpret what these actions are intended to do and to be about, because they clearly have much wider networks, and it's good to be kind of a magnet to pull some of the mainstream groups into more dramatic challenges to what the United States is presently prepared to do.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness. If you feel inspired to challenge what the U.S. is prepared to do, you can find more information on the website of Voices at www.nonviolence.org/VITW. And VITW is the abbreviation of Voices in the Wilderness. How such peace work might look like in practice becomes very vividly clear from Kathy Kelly's recent experience in occupied Palestine. Here is her account of how she and five other members of Voices entered the town of Jenin.
We would not have gotten into Jenin city or the Jenin camp without two particular sources of help. One was sometimes very young kids, Palestinian kids, who would risk quite a bit. I mean, maybe even their lives for all I know, but possible imprisonment and maybe physical harm while imprisoned, to guide people beyond checkpoints to tell them, okay, here's where you can get in. Because there was a great deal of sealed off closure in closed military areas. It's not very easy to get around. And so these kids would take a risk. Then when we were in the top of this mountainside is a place called Taibeh, and a Palestinian driver, when we were refused at a checkpoint there, drove us on, turned to us and said, can you run? And we said, okay, like a raindrop in my case. And we went sprinting down a mountainside 40 minutes in order to get to the village of Taibeh, where there was a car waiting for us. And it was quite a dramatic route for us, because there were surveillance planes overhead, F-16s, there were military jeeps on the ridge above, we were crouching under stubby trees. We thought this was so very, very dramatic. We got to the bottom of the road, where through cell phone contact we'd been able to communicate with the Palestinians who had a car to pick us up. And we were about to just spill out our story to them, and they kind of laughed and they said, oh, you see, this is what we do every day under military closure to avoid the checkpoints to go to our jobs. So then we were a bit more clued in as to how difficult it was to move. Internationals who had tried for several days to get to the Jenin camp had assured us there is no way that you can go. There are too many soldiers deployed as snipers, sniping if you go through the mountainsides, and they can't tell whether you're an American or a Palestinian. And there's no way that you'll get through the checkpoints. Soldiers had roughed up one journalist, had ripped up the passport of another. If the journalists weren't getting through, it just didn't seem likely. But we had seen on CNN the morning of April 14th refrigerated trucks that allegedly contained corpses that had been removed from the Jenin camp so that there would be a lessening of evidence of how many civilians might have been killed. There was no way to verify, was this story true or false? But we thought, well, all right, we're Americans. We come from the country that has spent $2 billion annually on funding the Israeli military. Couldn't we at least just go up to where they are and say, look, we paid for that Apache helicopter. We paid for that tank. We want to see what's inside those trucks. So with having nicked the pillowcases from the YWCA in East Jerusalem and borrowed a mop from the woman who was giving us housing, we made our next white flag and started off on the road. Now, we went into the Beit Salem checkpoint, which was 15 kilometers, 10 miles or so, outside of Jenin City, and with our white flag waving, walked in, and the Israeli soldiers said, why you wave this flag? We're not going to hurt you. So we put the flag down. We talked with them a little bit, walked into the checkpoint, didn't see the trucks anywhere, walked back out. Still, nobody seems to care that we're there, so we just thought, well, you know, we hear snipers and explosions, but let's just go along this road. In fact, it's called Route 66. So we started along the road, and quite soon there were military vehicles pulling up saying, you can't go on, it's too dangerous. What do you do here? Please, we don't inconvenience. Why do you want to cause us this trouble? And we explained we weren't trying to cause them any trouble or inconvenience. We understood the danger, dangerous for them as well, but we thought it was to their advantage to let unarmed people go forward and give witness to the idea of going forward in the future without weapons, without arms. Well, they weren't frightened by us. They weren't put off by us. We certainly weren't taking them by surprise, walking along in the middle of the road with our white flag. And so there was an impasse that didn't seem like it would be changeable, that they weren't going to let us go forward any further. So I sat down in the road. What I didn't know, and the two women with me also sat down, was that they couldn't arrest us. They had to have an Israeli police woman on hand to arrest women. So it really stuck them. They arrested the two men, took them back, booked them, said if they ever entered the West Bank again, they would be deported in 5 years exile, in a sense, wouldn't be able to re-enter. They didn't know who they were dealing with. Scott Schaefer Duffy and Jeff Gunzel immediately said so long, went to the top of the highest point in the mountainsides. They could see three little specks, which were the three nice girls. We were there. That's what the Israelis called us. You had three nice girls here. We give you bread. We give you water. Here, you need sunblock. Try not to hurt yourselves. And so we walked on. They saw us, and they went down one mountainside, up another, down another, exhausted, tired, hot, sweaty. The five of us reunited at 3:30 in the afternoon. We'd started out at 8 in the morning, and we went to the very final checkpoint, which turned out to be a huge encampment. And there were many, many different military vehicles, tanks, APCs, armored personnel carriers, jeeps, military people in bivouac tents. This was their big headquarters outside of Jenin City, and they assured us, sorry, we know you've come a long way, but you're going to have to go back. We assured them we're not going to turn around. Same standoff. They brought out a general. He said, I'm going to reiterate what's been said. You can't go forward. But when he turned away, one soldier who had something on his shoulders, he was some kind of an officer, said to us, well, technically, if you go back 100 meters and cross two fields, we can't stop you. We just said, bye. And we thought he was bluffing. We knew he wasn't because as soon as we turned around and followed his advice, seven other of his companion soldiers were screaming at him in Hebrew. And what did you let them do this for? So we just took off. We crossed through an onion field and two wheat fields. It took an hour and a half. The sun was starting to go down, and we realized now we're really stupid if the sun goes down and we're plowing through these fields, although by that time I was so utterly exhausted. My vote was we just lie down right now, sleep in the fields, and deal with tomorrow. But we managed to make it to Jenin City, by just keeping our eyes fixed on where some kids were playing, because we figured parents wouldn't let their kids play out in an area where the snipers were directly shooting. So we got there, and Palestinians were so amazed to see us. What are you doing here? They scooped us up and took us to a school where there were 800 people housed. Utter bedlam. These people had been there for 18 days without electricity. The kids were, you know, like popcorn. And but they were very good to us, and they introduced us to a doctor who was coordinating the distribution of blankets and water and food and relief. And then from there, the next morning, white flag again, we went to the outskirts of the Jenin camp. Soldiers said, "You cannot enter, closed military area, nobody goes in, we are sorry, please." And that's when we started to hear, "I am not responsible, I am only doing my job." We started the dialogue again, and once again, one soldier broke rank and said, "Well, if you go over two blocks, there's no checkpoint when you turn left." So we did that, and that's how we got into the city. But later on, they did let in one group of journalists who came as in a kind of convoy, almost herding. And that's when we met the grandmother, who was screaming. She was paralyzed from the waist down, having an asthma attack, greatly in need of immediate assistance. She really had to be gotten to medical help. And all the media people were very interested in her story. They were filming. And then the snipers fired right into that bevy of media. It was like when you turn on the lights, if you've ever lived in a building that has cockroaches. They disappeared. No offer to help the old woman. So our two guys, you know, she was quite heavy, and they carried her and started to carry her toward where she could ideally be closer to the hospital, although there was no road, you know. This is all the foundations that have been destroyed and buildings crumbled in on top of that. But at one point, Jeff and Andreas couldn't go any further with her, and they knelt down with the old woman in the road, and she was so terrified, you know, that she sees a tank in the distance, and this is her neighborhood, but there's no road anymore. And as I ran off to get a stretcher, and this is where high school teaching can really come in handy, I'm running along, and an Israeli Defense Force soldier is running at me with his gun aimed, and I just said, "Put that gun down," and kept going, because, you know, the greater need was clearly to get this stretcher, and of course he's not going to shoot me dead. But Jeff and Andreas were in the road with the woman, and somebody up above in an apartment was throwing things down. As it turned out, these soldiers were ransacking the home up above. And then just as a gesture, I think, of mockery or cruelty, one soldier started throwing down on the head of the old woman bottles, plates, cups. I think there was a very, very out of control kind of mentality amongst many of those young soldiers. So I say both and. We had discussions with some of them about novels we'd read, about Hannah Arendt, about André Schwarzbart, about Bernard Malamud, about Elie Wiesel. We talked to them about nonviolence. We talked to them about philosophy. And it was very easy to engage these young men and to say to them, "You could join Gush Shalom. You could join Yesh Gavul. You could join the Refuseniks. You could quit." And they would say, "Believe me, we prefer you your way to our way, and just we don't want to be here, but we have no choice." And we'd argue that one out. One fellow said, "It's easy for you to judge us from New York City." And we said, "But we don't judge you from American cities. We judge you from Jenin and from Nuremberg." And they understood this quite often, but there were some that were just really, really out of control. And there was there were plenty of crimes against humanity that were committed in Jenin, and certainly again in Nablus, and maybe in the future in Gaza. But I don't think that we as U.S. citizens really belong in the position of pointing fingers, because that finger has to point back at us. We are responsible, and we can do a great deal to control the warmongers, the warlords, who would dare to sit at negotiating tables in our country. We haven't exercised as much of the control that we could exercise that we should. I know there's a military-industrial media congressional complex in this country, and it's not easy. But the question is, how much are we willing to commit? I was trying to help prevent eviction of a family from a home in a day when we were in East Jerusalem, and I got to know a lovely young Jewish student, an Israeli young girl, And I said, well, you do quite a lot with this organization to try to prevent the evictions, don't you? And she said to me, yes, you know, I make a very big commitment. And to be here, I miss my pottery class. And I'm impressed. And yet, all of us have to say we have to do more than miss our pottery classes. It's a very, very dangerous reality we face right now. 200 to 400 thermonuclear weapons in Israel. Our own country having taken the whole world into the thermonuclear age and undermined the United Nations as a possibility for an alternative. But right now, the stakes are very, very high. This could well be one of the most dangerous times in history that any of us have ever faced in our adult lives. So I think we need to go through the inventory, the list. What are we prepared to do? And I would strongly recommend, even though for years I haven't even raised it, I would strongly recommend finding a way to do war tax refusal, whether it's your phone tax, the excise tax on your phone bill, or whether you just experiment for the next several months with saying, you know, you're not going to pay $20 of the federal income tax you're supposed to pay and redirect that $20, or give support to others in your community who will engage in war tax refusal. Consider being part of peace teams that go over to the West Bank or join us for a peace team in Iraq. But I think we all need to bump up and escalate the level of risk and sacrifice that we're willing to undertake right now. We wish the people had done it in Nazi Germany.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, a Chicago-based campaign to end the U.S.-UN sanctions against Iraq. During the first 2 weeks of the Gulf War, she was part of a peace encampment on the Iraq-Saudi border. She also went to Kosovo during the war there to witness the impact of U.S.-NATO bombing and lend some protection to the people on the ground. Currently, she's organizing peace teams to go into Iraq in the event of war. As I'm preparing this tape for broadcast at the end of October, Kathy Kelly is already in Iraq. If you are interested in joining the peace teams, prepare yourself for a rather lengthy application form. Short-term stays of no less than 2 weeks are possible, but applicants should plan on an indefinite stay, as there is no guarantee that roads leading in or out of the country will be easily navigated in the event of an assault or invasion. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Kathy Kelly and the Iraq Peace Teams on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this talk by Kathy Kelly by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelaiden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.